everyone. We are ready to proceed. The third member of this panel is Judge Alana Diamond-Rovner. She is unavailable this morning, but she will be listening to the oral argument via the tapes, and so we'll proceed. And with the first case, United States versus Arna Out, Mr. Brandt.
May it please the court, all three counsel for the government. I'm Jeff Brandt, counsel for Mr. Arnout on appeal. We submit that the district court erred in sentencing Mr. Arnout and ask this court to vacate the sentence and remand the matter to the district court. The district court first erred in at least four enhancements simply because those enhancements were not appropriate under the guidelines as they were, whether they're mandatory or not. But under the authority of Booker, we submit that all seven enhancements were unconstitutional because they were the result of a Sixth Amendment violation, imposition of additional sentence based upon factors found by a judge, not admitted by the defendant, and not submitted to a jury, because they were the result of an unlawful procedure.
Let me ask you about the diversion of funds. As part of the plea agreement, didn't your client admit to diverting funds aimed at helping refugees?
He did admit to diverting $196,000 and change, but he was not sentenced upon that amount.
Right, but at least as to that amount, it's undisputed that he diverted it, so that part at least could be preserved.
We would submit that there's still an error as to that enhancement because it was increased. But you're correct, Your Honor, he made a, quote, admission. I think there may be a technical question in the future, but not in this case, of whether that admission is a Blakely or a Booker admission, because he did not make that admission knowing he had a right to a jury trial on that fact. But in this case, I would submit that Mr. Arnout would not contest that figure upon remand to the district court. If this court were considering doing something other than remanding it, we would submit, maybe remanding it with specific directions on how to handle that sentence or something more creative. We would submit that, yes, maybe a base offense level of 10 for that amount of loss would be appropriate under the advisory guidelines. That's only part of the story, as the court knows. There are a total of seven enhancements, and there were no admissions in the plea agreement that addressed each of these enhancements. We would submit that if we're not looking at Booker, let me ask the court, is the court interested in any argument that doesn't address Booker, the advisory guidelines arguments?
Since there's a missing member of the court, you do whatever you want to play.
Wow, in my wildest dreams, I didn't expect that. I think the most important factor for this court and for the other courts that have addressed this issue already, which is the Second, the Fourth, and the Sixth, the question is whether, how much has been preserved and what is the question, what needs to happen. We would submit first that there's absolutely no question that Booker and Blakely apply to this case, as the remedy opinion by Justice Breyer made clear that the holding of Booker must be applied to every case on direct review. We would also submit that Mr. Arnout has preserved this argument because on at least two of the enhancements, he challenged the sufficiency of the evidence. He challenged the weight and the quality of the evidence and the underlying Sixth Amendment argument, which is the amount of proof that has been presented to this court, in this court, does not satisfy an amount necessary to impose an enhancement.
Well, certainly the court didn't err in applying the enhancement that relates to affecting more than 50 victims.
We would submit for two reasons. The answer is yes. We've appealed that on non-Booker or Blakely grounds, on the grounds that the government didn't submit any evidence that showed that there were more than 50 victims. albeit he did not object in the lower court, but we have raised a plain error argument outside of the Booker argument that the evidence did not show that there were more than 50 victims. The government presented evidence of how many donors there were, of how much money in total was donated, and Mr. Arnout submitted and admitted that some funds were diverted.
Well, weren't there actually more than 17,000 donors, and weren't they actually victims of the fraud because the money was diverted to a purpose other than what was stated as to the reason they were making the donations?
Your Honor's correct that those number of people were told something that turned out not to be true. That
you
one
mean it was a lie?
You could call it that, Your Honor.
No, I did. So could you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Give it a shot.
In my zealous advocacy for my client, I'm going to have to decline, but I appreciate Your Honor's suggestion.
So why weren't they victims?
Well, we'd submit, are they victims of fraud if it was not their donation of money that was diverted?
And well, if they were lied to, they were victims of fraud. You would agree that generally that's true.
Generally that's true, Your Honor.
Right. And so how are you dancing around that in this case?
If I'm dancing, I guess the issue we're addressing is whether those the money that those people donated was diverted, or whether the money that those people donated was used for the proper purpose.
And didn't your client admit that the funds were diverted?
He admitted that $1,960,000 of approximately $20 million was diverted. Correct.
Right, and that those funds came from those more than 50-plus donors, correct?
No. Well, that those funds came from some of those overall donors, which were the total number of donors did exceed 50. That's correct. But all this might mean nothing in light of Booker. Certainly in light of Booker, not only was this plain error because he didn't admit the facts that constitute this enhancement, but on this enhancement, even if this court finds that he made that admission, the procedure upon which he was sentenced is unconstitutional. The district court committed reversible error with this in particular enhancement because it mandatorily applied the applicable guideline range. Justice Breyer's remedy opinion made clear that even if a resulting sentence did not violate the Sixth Amendment, even if it did not violate the Sixth Amendment, a judge errs by mandatorily acting under the now excised 3553B1. Duncan Fanfan, in the companion case, did not have a Sixth Amendment error because the district court imposed an alternative sentence. Nevertheless, the U.S. Supreme Court remanded the matter to the district court. The reason seems to be the procedure. It's not only a Sixth Amendment violation, as was in Mr. Freddie Booker's case, but in Mr. Duncan's case, there was an alternative sentence that did not violate the Sixth Amendment, yet the U.S. Supreme Court found there was an error anyway because the unconstitutional statute, 18 U.S.C. 3553B1, was used. So we submit with all enhancements, even if there's no Sixth Amendment violation, there was an error, so that the matter needs to be remanded. We'd submit that there's plain error because a constitutional right has been violated. An unconstitutional section of the statute has been used, and that these affect his substantial rights because he's been prejudiced. Again, although we submit that there's no reason for the plain error analysis and that he has preserved this to at least a couple of enhancements, and so all of them that we submit that there is plain error that this court should recognize. At the very least, this court may need to remand to determine whether plain error has occurred, because it may be impossible for this court to determine whether the last element, whether it substantially affects his rights, has occurred. And that is because the question exists whether the district court would have materially altered the sentence had it known that the Booker and the Blakely decisions would be handed down.
Yeah, but it's your position that really you would like to see all of those enhancements go back to the district court and for us not to parse the ones that we think might stand up or might not stand up. Is that your position?
That is our position.
That the district court would have to look at all of those enhancements again and put all of them in context now that the guidelines are advisory.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's because of the Fanfan decision. The part of this decision, the remedy part of the decision, that says even if there's no Sixth Amendment violation, even if there's an admission, we have an error because there's this unconstitutional section of the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984 that has been used. If there are no further questions, I would sit
down.
You'll
save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, please.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Good morning. I am John Kokoris, and I represent the United States. And I would like to start by focusing on the district court's failure to apply the enhancement in Guideline Section 3A1.4, which is referred to as the terrorism enhancement. The district court's failure to apply that sentence, to apply that enhancement, resulted in a sentence that was less than 60% of the sentence that the defendant should have received. And under Booker, that is an unreasonable sentence.
But the district court found there was no evidence that he attempted, participated in, or conspired to commit an act of terrorism.
Correct. The district court found that there was no evidence that he conspired or participated in an act of terrorism. But Section 3A1.4 reaches to conduct that goes beyond participating in acts. It reaches obstructing terrorism investigations. It reaches to harboring and concealing investigations of terrorism, and that's right in Application Note 2. Specifically, 3A1.4 reaches conduct that involves or is intended to promote a federal crime of terrorism. And the district court's reading of the provision strikes the language involves or intended to promote. The two federal courts of appeals decisions on point on this issue disagree with the district court and say that that language, involved and intended to promote, has to be given meaning. And as I mentioned, Application Note 2 to 3A1.4 specifically states that obstructing a terrorism investigation, an obstruction is not a specifically listed terrorism offense. Nevertheless, an offense that involves the obstruction of a federal terrorism investigation shall be considered to have involved or been intended to promote a federal crime of terrorism.
But those two cases you mentioned, the facts were different than the facts that we have before us, weren't they?
Certainly, they were different. Both of those cases involved conspiracy charges where the objects of the conspiracy did involve federal crimes of terrorism. Nevertheless, under the district court's ruling, if those cases were before this district court, the terrorism enhancement would not have applied because neither of those defendants were convicted of a federal crime of terrorism that's specifically listed in Section 2332 BG5 of Title 18, just as defendant in this case was not convicted of a federal crime of terrorism. What he was convicted of was participating in a broad, long-term RICO conspiracy. Defraud donors. And it's important to keep in mind why he was defrauding donors. He wasn't defrauding donors to line his pockets with money. He was defrauding donors to provide money and resources to fighters overseas. And that's where the terrorism offense comes in. In addition, the judge found, and the evidence is beyond dispute, that he obstructed an investigation of a federal crime of terrorism. In late 2001, the funds of the Benevolence International Foundation, which he operated, were frozen by the Department of Treasury under a provision which allows Treasury to freeze funds pending investigation of an organization for connections to terrorism. The defendant himself acknowledged at sentencing that he knew then that he was under intensive investigation following the acts on September 11th, 2001. Those monies were frozen. The defendant and his lawyers filed a lawsuit against the government to unfreeze those funds. And at the outset of that litigation, the defendant filed a motion for a preliminary injunction seeking the immediate release to his organization of those funds. In support of that motion for a preliminary injunction, the defendant filed, as Exhibit A sworn statement that said BIF, his charity, has never provided any aid or support to any person or organization engaged in violence or terrorist activities. That was a lie. He filed that affidavit twice. He did it to get his money back, presumably so he could continue to fund fighters overseas as he had been doing for a decade. The judge found that that obstruction related to his offenses because it was directly linked to his fraudulent conduct that was at the core of his RICO conspiracy conviction. And his sentence was enhanced two levels accordingly. However, that conduct alone, those false affidavits under Application Note 2 trigger application of the enhancement in Section 3A1.4, and that enhancement should have been applied. But beyond that, even if there had been no obstruction, that enhancement should have been applied because he was sending money to fighters overseas and was violating Section 2339A of Title 18 in doing so. And the guidelines instruct that all of the relevant conduct should be considered and not just the offense of conviction, and 3A1.4 is no different.
Can we move to the Booker issues? Because, I mean, the question I have for you on all of those enhancements is how do we know, or how can we determine how the district court would have sentenced the defendant if it had been given the broader sentencing discretion that it now enjoys under Booker? And without knowing that, how can we determine whether the pre-Booker sentence was reasonable?
There are two ways to know that the sentence wasn't unreasonably high. The government contends that it was unreasonably low. First, the district court sentenced the defendant directly in the middle of the applicable guidelines range. If the district court felt that the sentence under the guidelines was too high, the district court would have sentenced him at minimum to the bottom of the range and would have considered a downward departure. Not only did the district court sentence the defendant to the middle of the range and not consider a downward departure, but the district court, sua sponte, imposed an upward departure of two levels, which was addressed earlier, for the harm that was caused to these refugees who are depending on these donations for life-saving assistance. And so those two factors, the sentence in the middle of the range and the upward departure, clearly show that the district court felt that the resulting sentence, 136 months, was reasonable.
Well, aren't you speculating as to what the district court actually thought? I mean, the district court made this decision in the context of a mandatory scheme. And district judges come to these guidelines with different perspectives and different ways that they actually apply the guidelines. And how are we to know that's true? I mean, we would be substituting our judgment really for the district courts if we agreed with your position, wouldn't we?
We can't know for certain it's true without the district court pronouncing that this is what the district court would have imposed had the guidelines merely been advisory. However, it is important to remember that this case comes before you on plain error review. The defendant did not make a Sixth Amendment objection in the district court, and he asserted that challenging the sufficiency of the evidence on two of the four enhancements that he challenges here was sufficient to preserve the issue. It's not. Challenging the sufficiency of the evidence is a far cry from challenging whether the scheme violates the Sixth Amendment. And on plain error review, the defendant cannot meet the third and fourth prongs of the test set forth in the Supreme Court's Cotton case. Particularly, he cannot show that his sentence calls into question the fairness or integrity of the judicial proceedings, the fourth prong, especially here when he's been sentenced to the middle of the range and the court sua sponte upward departed two levels. And for those reasons, the sentence, his challenges to the sentence under Booker should fail. In addition, on two of the enhancements, the defendant agreed to their application, whether there were more than 50 victims. He did not challenge that in the district court. The government did not present evidence specifically on the number of victims, apart from informing the court that there were over 17,000 donors to this charity and well over $300,000 was diverted over a decade. We didn't make that presentation because the defendant had agreed that that enhancement applied. The defendant also agreed that a substantial part of his fraud was committed overseas, another enhancement he challenges here. So again, there was no reason to develop an evidentiary record on that because it was agreed to. With regard to the loss amount, the defendant contends that the court erred by including $66,000 of what he represents was abandoned property. And it's important to note that nowhere does the evidence in the record support the proposition that this was abandoned property. This property was provided to Bosnian fighters, and it was included in the loss calculation because the defendant had in his office what was titled a letter of gratitude from Bosnian fighters thanking BIF for 2,000 uniforms, 2,000 pairs of boots, 10 mass communication resources, which may be walkie-talkies, that were distributed by BIF from the end of 1992 through June of 1994. The court cut, the government appraised these items and gave an estimated value of these items to the court, and the court cut that amount in half. And the defendant contends that none of it should have been included because it was abandoned, but nowhere does the record show that it was abandoned, and common sense suggests otherwise. These materials were parceled out over 2 years. They were valuable materials, particularly in war-torn Bosnia, and the defendant was in the business of providing materials just like these to fighters in other areas. For these reasons, Your Honor, the government respectfully requests that this court determine that the sentence in this case was unreasonably low and remand the matter for resentencing.
Thank you, Mr. Kapoor. Rebuttal? How much time?
2.5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe the court was correct when it came to the question of whether a terrorism enhancement was proper, that the district court made a finding of fact that the conduct in this case had no relation to terrorism, including no intention to promote terrorism. And our reply brief, pages 19 and 20, we quote the district court in making that finding of fact and would encourage this court to find that there's no clear error in that finding.
Well, why
of
don't
fact.
You speak to those two cases that counsel cited and the interpretation of those courts of the particular statute?
We believe the court's absolutely correct that the facts are so different in those cases that they cannot be followed here, in addition to the fact that there is no underlying obstruction of justice conviction in this case. It would be a further Sixth Amendment violation to find that somehow Mr. Arnout was convicted of an obstruction offense when, at best for the government, there was proof to preponderance of the evidence that enhancement should apply. We'd submit that because that's a question of fact that the district court has already resolved, totally understanding those other two cases, that we encourage this court not to upset that question of fact. When it comes to the abandoned property, that again is a question of fact. The government stands up here and says there's no evidence showing that it was abandoned property. There is that evidence, and the district court found that the property was abandoned. Their argument is a question of law. Is that loss? And we submit that that is loss because no one lost anything except the charity that gave up that property. Did donors lose anything? No. Nobody lost anything except the people that lost that property, and those people are not a party to this case. We submit that there's no question of reasonableness for this court yet because the district court has already unconstitutionally sentenced Mr. Arnout. If this case comes before this court again, we would submit there's a question of reasonableness. If this court finds that it has to determine a question of reasonableness, we would find that it's unreasonable to use an unconstitutional section of the Sentencing Reform Act to sentence someone. We also submit that we can meet the third and fourth prongs of the plain error test because the fairness and integrity of this court's proceedings is certainly upset when someone is materially punished in addition to what's proper under the Sixth Amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement. Thank you, counsel.